So, welcome to day two of ICASP. Good morning, everyone. And first, a couple of practical remarks. So, we have a change of room. You know that this Club D was really small, and we were afraid that people would not fit in. So, we moved everything from Club D and the expert sessions from Club B to the North Hall. It's actually above this panorama hall on the second floor next to the exhibition, and we should have more space there. So it will be announced. Actually, Club D should be closed, and well, signs will be there. Then for the internet, really sorry for the troubles yesterday. That was caused by T-Mobile, by the provider. They had some strange problems with their hotspot. So today it should be available again, but please, we have just 512 slots available, and there is no easy way to obtain more. So please disconnect when you do not need to be online, and this is especially for smartphone owners, because the smartphones would hook on and just stay there all the day long. Then for the banquet or Czech dinner, we have tonight. You need the tickets. I'm sorry for that, but if you don't have ticket, you won't be allowed to get on the bus or in Joffin Palace. There is still a very limited number of tickets available at the registration desk. Then the departure of buses is right after the last session at 6:45 from entrance number 10. And transportation back from Joffin is not provided, so take metro, cabs, or continue your evening in these many pubs and bars in the center of Prague. And I'm pretty much done, so there will be a short introduction of ASRU done by Bhuvana Ramabhadran from IBM.
Good morning, everybody. Not to take away too much time from our keynote today, but I want you all to mark your calendars. This year's Automatic Speech Recognition and Understanding Conference or workshop is in Big Island, Hawaii. Think beautiful beaches. It's going to be in December 11th through 15th. Most importantly, our paper deadline is July 1st. We have lined up a nice bunch of speakers in a wide range of topics, ranging from neuronal speech modeling all the way to computer vision and machine learning and all the key areas in speech recognition and understanding. So please do come, please submit papers, and we look forward to seeing you at ASRU. Thank you.
Thank you, Bhuvana, and there is time for the second plenary. So it's going to be given by Nelson Morgan from ICSI in Berkeley, and Hina Germanski, with the correct pronunciation of the name, will introduce our speaker and chair this session. Hinku, please.
Thank you very much for coming so early in the morning. I hope that you won't be disappointed. It is my great pleasure to introduce Professor Nelson Morgan, who is the director of International Computer Science Institute in Berkeley and professor at residence there at the Electrical and Computer Engineering Department. Professor Morgan, for those who don't know him, has been involved in speech for a very long time. He's a co-author and author of a number of techniques which we all are using. He also educated a number of students, a number of them sitting here in the audience, I can see. So for those people, Nelson Morgan doesn't need much of introduction. But for those of you who don't know him, he's also co-author of a well-used book together with one of the pioneers of digital signal processing, Ben Gold, and it's coming out as a new edition, co-authored also with Alice from Colombia. What else can I say? Well, I think I will keep it short. I will call Nelson Morgan here, and he will give you a talk that will be better than looking at me and listening to me. Morgan, please.
Thanks, Enoch. Well, I thought it was time for a little bit of a reality check on speech recognition. And it's been around for a long time, as I think everybody here knows, very long research history, lots of publications for decades, many projects, many sponsored projects. Systems have continually gotten better. They've actually tended to converge so that there is, in some sense, a standard automatic speech recognition system now. It's made it to a lot of commercial products. It's actually been used. It actually works from time to time. And so in some sense, it seems to have graduated. But ASR fails where humans don't. And by the way, those of you who have your PhDs know that your education hopefully was not done at that point. And there's probably a lot more to do here. Some would argue that there is little basic science that's been developed in quite a bit of time. Lots of good engineering methods, though, but they often require a great amount of data. As we learned yesterday, there is a great deal of data, but not all of it is available for use in the way that you'd like. And there are many tasks where you don't have that much. And each new task requires essentially the same amount of effort. You sort of have to start over again. So how did we get to this point? This is not going to be anything like a complete history, but enough to make my point, I hope. So I'm going to talk about the status, current status, and the standard methods very briefly. Talk about some of the alternatives that people have worked with over the years, and where could we go from here? So, as I mentioned, speech recognition research has been around for a very long time, significant papers for 60 years. By the 1970s, in some sense, the major advances in modeling had happened. That is, the basic mathematics behind hidden Markov models was done by then. There have been lots of improvements that happened for the next 20 years or so, and also in the features, which became more or less standard by 1990 or so. There were some really important methodology improvements by 1990. In earlier days, people did many experiments, but it was very hard to compare them. And the notions of standard evaluations and standard data sets really took hold by 1990 or so. And over all of these years, especially the last 20, 30 years, there have been continuous improvements, which were to some extent really closely related to Moore's law improvements in the technology. That is, more and more computational capability, more and more storage capability, allowing people to work with very large data sets and develop very large models to well represent those large data sets, and so on. So there's an elephant in the room, which is that things are not entirely working still. With these systems that in fact have converged, it was kind of a byproduct of all of these standard evaluations, which were very good in many ways, but when people found out that the other group had something that they didn't, they would copy it, and very soon the system would become very much the same. So what are some of the remaining problems? Well, systems still perform pretty poorly, despite a large amount of work on this, in the presence of significant amounts of acoustic noise. Also, reverberation, which is natural for just about any situation. Unexpected speaking rate or accent, that is, by unexpected I mean something that is not well represented in the training set. Unfamiliar topics, the language models bring us a lot of the performance that we have, and if you don't have a particular topic represented in the language model, it can do poorly. And aside from the recognition performance per se, how many words you get right, another thing that's important is knowing whether you're right or wrong. And that's very important for practical applications, and that still needs some work as well. So it turns out that even some fairly simple speech recognition tasks can still fail under some of these conditions, yielding some strange results.
Whoop. Oh, no, they installed voice recognition technology in us, lift, I heard about us.
Voice recognition technology in a lift in Scotland? You ever tried voice recognition technology?
No.
They don't do Scottish accents.
11.
Could you please repeat that?
11.
11. 11.
11.
Could you please repeat that?
11.
Whose idea was this? You need to try an American accent.
11. 11.
That sounds Irish, not American.
Not Disney.
11.
Where in America is that? Dublin.
I'm sorry. Could you please repeat that?
Try an English accent, right?
11! 11!
You for the same part of England as Dick Van Dyke?
Listen, yours ain't smart ass.
Please speak slowly and clearly.
Smart ass! 11!
I'm sorry. Could you please repeat that?
11! If you don't understand a lingo, a way back came to your own country.
Anyway, so that was funny. I hope you think it was funny. But what hasn't worked in real life as opposed to just the jokes? And what has? So let me start off with some results from some of these standard evaluations I referred to. This is a graph that people in speech have seen a million times. Let me use this other one. For those of you who aren't familiar with this, the main thing to note is that WER stands for word error rate. High word error rate is obviously bad. This is time on this axis. And each of these lines represents a series of tasks. Now, this is a kind of messy graph, so let's clean it up a little. And this is a task done in the early 90s called ADIS. And the main thing to see here, as with a lot of these, is that it starts off at a pretty high error rate. People work for a while, and after a while, it gets down to a pretty reasonable error rate. Okay, let's go to another one. This was a conversational telephone speech. You have the same sort of effect. And do remember that this is a logarithmic scale here. So even though it looks like it hasn't come down very far, it really did come down pretty far. But after a while, sort of levels off. More recently, there's been a bunch of work on speech from meetings, which is also conversational. These are from the individual head-mounted microphones, so you still didn't have huge effects of background noise or reverberation or anything. And there wasn't actually a huge amount of progress after some of the initial work. Now, these are these evaluations. Commercial products, I think a lot of the information is proprietary. But I think what we can say is that the commercial products work some of the time for some people, and they often don't work for others. So what is the state? Well, the recognition systems will either work really well for somebody, or they'll be terribly brittle and unreliable. I know that when my wife and I both tried dictation systems, they worked wonderfully for her and terrible for me. I think I swallow my words sometimes. So here's an abbreviated review of what's standard. By 1991, we had feature extraction basically being based on frames every 10 milliseconds or so. You compute something from a short-term spectrum, things called malfrequency Kestrel coefficients, which I'll mention a bit more about in a second. PLP is another common method developed by then. Delta Kestra, essentially temporal derivatives of the Kestra. And on the statistical side, acoustic modeling, hidden Markov models were quite standard. They typically, by this point, represented context-dependent phoneme or units or phoneme-like units. The language models were pretty much, by this time, all statistical, and they represented context-dependent words. So all of this was standard by 1991. Now let's move to 2011. There it is. Notice all the changes. Okay, that's a little unfair. People have actually done work in the last 20 years, and this is a representation of a lot of it, I think. And these have had big effects. I don't mean to minimize them. There's various kinds of normalizations, mean invariance kind of normalizations, an online version of that we called RASTA, vocal track length normalization, which compresses or expands the spectrum in such a way as to match the models better. Then adaptation and feature transformation, either adapting better to a test set that's somewhat different from the training set, or various changes to make the features more discriminative. Discriminative training, actually changing the statistical models in such a way as to make them more discriminant between different speech sounds. We did have more and more data over the years, and that required lots of work to figure out how to handle that. But aside from handling, it was also taking advantage of lots of data, which didn't come for free. So there was lots of engineering work there. People found that combining systems helped, and sometimes combining pieces of systems helped. And that's been an important thing in improving performance. And because speech recognition was starting to go into applications, you had to be concerned about speed. And there's been a lot of work on that. A little bit more on some of this. The main point about Mellkepstrom and PLP I want to make is that each of them use this kind of warped frequency scale in which you have better resolution at low frequencies than at high frequencies, because our perception of different speech sounds is very different at low frequencies and high frequencies. Mellkepstrom and PLP used different mechanisms for getting a smooth spectrum. Deltakepstrom, as I said, is basically time derivatives of the Kepstrom. Hidden Markov model, this is a graphical form of it. And main thing to see here, this is a statistical dependency graph. And say X3 is only dependent on the current state. Each of these time steps are represented here. And if you know Q3, then Q2, Q1, X1, X2 tell you nothing about X3. So that's a very, very strong statistical conditional independence model, and that's pretty much what people have used in these what are now standard systems. This is my only equation, and those of you in speech will go, oh yeah. In fact, probably most people will say, oh yeah. This basically Bayes' rule. The idea is that in a statistical system, you want to pick the model that is most probable given the data. And Bayes' rule says you can expand it in this way, and then you can get rid of the P of X because there's no dependence on the model there. Okay. So you realize these likelihoods of probability of the acousticity of the model with mixtures of Gaussians typically. You typically have each Gaussian just represented by means and variances. There's no covariance represented between the features, and there's the weights of each of the Gaussians. The language priors, the P of M, are implemented with n-grams. You do a bunch of counting, you do some smoothing, and it's basically the probability of a word given some word history, such as the recent n-1 words. Now, the math is lovely, but in practice, we actually raise each of these things to some kind of power. This is to compensate for the fact that the model's wrong and that there are really other dependencies. This is a picture of the acoustic likelihood estimator. There's a few steps in here. Each of these boxes can actually be fairly complicated, but just generally speaking, there's some kind of short-term spectral estimation. There's this vocal tract length normalization I mentioned, which compresses or expands the spectrum. There's some kind of smoothing, either by throwing away some of the upper Kepstrom coefficients or by autoregressive modeling, as is done in PLP. There's various kinds of linear transformations, for instance, for dimensionality reduction and for discrimination, better discrimination. And then there's the statistical engine that I mentioned before with this funny scaling in the log domain or raising to a power in order to mix with the language model. Okay, well, that seems simple enough, but actual systems that get the very best scores are a bit more complicated than this. First off, there's the decoder and the language priors coming in. Well, you might have two of these, for instance. And people have found that this is very helpful for getting best performance. But you don't just put them in a very simple way. It's very often the case that you have all sorts of stages with CW here is crossword or non-crossword models, and you produce graphs or lattices, and you combine them at different points, and you cross-adapt. Well, this kind of reminds me of some work by a Berkeley grad of about a century ago named Rube Goldberg. And this is the self-operating napkin. The self-operating napkin is activated when the soup spoon A is raised to mouth, pulling string B, and thereby jerking ladle C, which throws cracker D past parrot E. Parrot jumps after cracker, and perch F tilts, which upsets G into pail H. The extra weight in the pail pulls the cord I, which opens, and which lights the cigarette lighter J,
And this turn lights the rocket, which pulls the sickle, which cuts the string, which allows the pendulum to swing back and forth, thereby wiping the chin. So this is kind of my view of current speech recognition systems. It's successful at wiping the chin sometimes. So I want to talk a little bit about alternatives, and I want to say at the outset that these are just some of the alternatives. A conference like this has a lot of work, happily, in many different directions. But these are the ones I wanted to give as examples. But first I want to say a little bit about what else is there besides the main approaches. The great sage Nasruddin was tracked down by a seeker. And the seeker asked the sage, "What is the secret to happiness?" The sage answered, "Good judgment." Well, the seeker said, that's all very well, master, but how does one obtain good judgment?" And the master said, "From experience." So the seeker thought, okay, experience, but how does one obtain this experience? And the master said, "Bad judgment." So here are some exercises that we and many other people have done in bad judgment. We've pursued different signal representations. Some of them are related to perception, to auditory models, for instance. Mean rate and synchrony, such as Senef's model from some time ago, and ensemble interval histogram from Oded Gitza. Each of these were related to models of neural firings. How fast they went, how much they synchronized with one another, what timing there was between the firings. And they had some interesting performance in noise. They have not been adopted in any serious way, but there's interesting technology there, interesting scientific models, actually. Then there's stuff that's more on the psychological side. These were sort of based on models of physiology. Then there's a model of really from the psychological side on multi-band systems based on critical bands going all the way back to Fletcher's work and the work of others. The idea here is that if you have a system that's just looking at part of the spectrum, if the disturbance is in that part of the spectrum, then you can deal with it separately. And those have had some success. And then something that you can observe both at the physiological and psychological level is the importance of different modulations, particularly temporal, but also spectral modulations in the signal. Then there's on the production side, there's been a bunch of work by people on, given the fact that there's only a few articulatory mechanisms, that maybe you can represent things that way and it'll be more succinct and a better representation of the signal and represent this over time. And there have been hidden dynamic models that attempt to do this, and trajectory models. Sometimes the trajectory models had nothing to do with physiological models, but sometimes they did. And articulatory features, which you could think of as a quantized version of the articulator positions and so forth. Then another direction was artificial neural networks, which have been around for a very long time. Actually before 1961, but I picked out this one, discriminant analysis, iterative design. I picked that out because a lot of people don't know about it. A lot of people think that multi-layer networks began in the 80s. But actually in 1961, they had a multi-layer network that worked very well for some problems and was actually used industrially for decades after that, in which the first layer of units was a bunch of Gaussians, and after that you had linear perceptrons. A couple years later, there was work at Stanford in which they actually did apply some of this kind of stuff to speech. These were actually linear adaptive units, which they called ADLINES. Bernie Woodrow sent me a technical report, just for historical interest. There's the cover. It's a real technical report from 1963. There's a page from it that shows a block diagram, which I blew up here for convenience. And starts off with some bandpass filters, basically getting some power measures in each band. And then here are these ad lines, which give you some sets of outputs, which went to a typewriter, apparently. 1980s saw an explosion of interest in the neural network area. Part of this was sparked by a rediscovery, I'd say, of error back propagation, which was basically propagating the effect of errors from the output of the system back to the individual weights. In the late 80s, a number of us worked on hybrid HMM artificial neural network systems, where the neural networks were used as probability estimators to get the emission probabilities for the HMM. Last decade or so, quite a few people have taken off on the tandem idea, which is a particular way of using artificial neural networks as feature extractors. And I will just mention briefly a fairly recent development of deep networks and how innovative it is a question, but there's definitely some new things going on there, which I think are interesting. The obvious difference between this and the previous networks is there tend to be more layers, and hence deep. There's also sometimes an unsupervised pre-training. There's actually several papers at this conference. There's also a special issue in November of the transactions. Here's a couple papers at this conference. I think there's a few others as well. There's one from Vignels and Ravuri. They had a lot of different numbers in the paper, but I picked one out and most of the numbers had this same general trend. MFCCs, bad. Deep MLP, good. And the old MLP, somewhere in between. These are error rates, so low, again, low is good. And there's a large vocabulary voice search paper, which was at a poster yesterday, had a 16%, their metric was sentence error reduction. And they had a nice improvement compared to a system that used MPE, which is a very common discriminative training approach. Okay, so those are just some of the alternatives. And again, I'm sure many of the people in this audience could think of many others. Where could we go from here? Or, in my opinion, where should we go from here? Well, better features and models. I've suggested better models of hearing and production could perhaps lead to better features. Better models of these features, better acoustic models. Models of understanding, better language models, dialogue models, pragmatics, and so on. All of these are likely to be important. The other thing which I'm going to go into a bit, especially at the end, is understanding the errors, understanding what the assumptions are that are going into our models and how to get past them. So let me start with models of hearing. So there are useful approximations to the action of the periphery, that is, from here to the auditory nerve. And when I say useful approximations, I mean that there are a number of people who have worked on simplifying the models that were used earlier and crafting them more towards good engineering tools. Some of those are looking kind of promising. There's newer information about the auditory cortex, which I'm going to briefly refer to in the next few slides, including some results with noise. It's good to learn from biological examples because humans are pretty good in many situations at recognizing speech, but it's probably good also not to be a purist and to mix insights that you get from these things with good engineering approaches. And I think there's some good possibilities there. This bottom bullet is just to note that, as with many things in this talk, I'm only talking about some of the field, and I'm mostly talking about single channel, but people have two ears, they make pretty good use of them when they work, and that's something to keep in mind. And of course you can go to many ears in some situations with microphone arrays, and that's a good thing to think about, but it's not a topic that I'm expanding on in this talk. And the same thing with visual information. Visual information is used by people whenever they can. And I'm not going to talk about that, but it's obviously important. Okay, I was going to talk about this cortical stuff. This slide is courtesy of Shiab Sharma. It's not just the slide, but also the ideas. And the idea, which comes from experiments that he and his guys and gals have done with small mammals that have pretty similar early part of the cortex, primary auditory cortex, to what people have. There's also been some other work with people. And these, this, if you imagine this as being the kind of spectrogram that's received at this primary auditory cortex, what they've observed is that there's a bunch of what are called spectrotemporal receptive fields, or STRFs, which are little filters that process it in time and frequency. And you could think of them as processing temporal modulations, which he called rate, and spectral modulations, which he called scale. And you imagine there being a cube at each time point with auditory frequency and rate and scale. And much as you would like to be able to, in a regular spectrogram, de-emphasize the areas where the signal to noise was poor and emphasize areas where the signal to noise was good, you have perhaps an even greater chance to do this kind of emphasis, de-emphasis, if you're expanded out to this cube. That's the general idea. So you could end up with a lot of these different spectrotemporal receptive fields. You could implement them, and you could try to do something good with them, pick out the good ones. An implementation that we and a number of people have been trying is a what we would call a many-stream implementation, as opposed to multi-stream, which was what I was showing before. We'd have two or three streams, just refers to the quantity. But what's in each stream is one of the a representation of one of these spectrotemporal receptive fields implemented by a Gabor filter and by a multi-layer perceptron that's discriminatively trained, discriminant between different speech sounds. So you get a whole lot of these. In some of our implementations, we have 300. And then you have to figure out how to combine them or select them, hopefully, again, to de-emphasize the ones that are bad indicators of what was said. So another interesting sidelight of this kind of approach is that it's a good fit to modern high-speed computing methods. As I think a lot of you know, the clock rates are no longer going up the way they used to on our CPUs. And so the way that manufacturers are trying to give us more performance is by having many more cores. And the graphics processors are an extreme example of this. This kind of structure is a really good match to that because it's what they call embarrassingly parallel. We found that this kind of approach does remove a significant number of errors, particularly in noise, but also, as it turns out, in their clean conditions. It combines well with pure engineering, not auditory kind of methods, such as Wiener filter-based methods. And we'd like to think that it could combine well with other auditory models, although we haven't really done that work yet. Statistical acoustic models. We currently use these critical assumptions. And one of the things about using very different kinds of features is that this can really change their statistical properties from the ones we have now. And so these assumptions could be violated in yet different ways. There have been alternate models that have been proposed that allow you to bypass these typical assumptions, but part of the problem is to figure out which statistical dependencies to put in. Models of language and understanding, I think it's probably pretty clear, even those of you who don't know me, that this isn't my research area, but it's of obvious importance. And one of the things that has been frustrating to a lot of people, in fact, I remember Fred Jelinek being particularly frustrated about this, is that it's very, very tough to get much improvement over simple n-grams, that is, probability of a word given some number of previous words. But it can be very important to get further information, and we know this for sure for people. Let me tell you a little story. One day, I was walking out of ICSI, and I had on one of these caps. This is a cap for the Oakland Athletics, the local Major League Baseball club. I also had on a jacket that had the same insignia on it, and I had a radio held to my head, and I was walking down the street. And a guy across the street, moderately noisy street, yelled, "Or!" And I said, "Oakland A's, 5-3. Anyway, we'd like to be able to do that with our machines. So where do we go from here? Well, researchers will continue to get good ideas. Every time you get in the shower, maybe you have a good idea coming out. But what's the best methodology? What's the best way to proceed along this path? So maybe we can learn from some other disciplines. And let me give a kind of stretched analogy to the search for a cure for cancer. And again, I'm going to tell you a little story. This is a personal one. It's about an uncle of mine named Sidney Farber. Now, my uncle Sidney in the 40s was a pathologist at Harvard Med Center and at Children's Hospital in Boston. And he, unfortunately, got to see lots of little children die of leukemia. Once they were diagnosed, they only had a few weeks. He was a pathologist. He mostly dealt with petri dishes and so forth. He wasn't really a clinician. But he got this thought that maybe if you could come up with chemicals that were more poisonous to the cancer cells than they were to the normal cells, maybe he could extend the lives of these kids. So he experimented with this in the petri dishes, of course, for the most part, for a while. And then he came up with something that he thought would work. And he tried it out, with everybody's permission, on some of these kids. And lo and behold, it actually did extend their lives for a while. This was the first known case of chemotherapy. So this was great, and it started a whole revolution. They ended up starting a big center, National Cancer Institute stuff. It's now called the Dana-Farber Institute. And the key point I want to make about it is that there's this quandary between curing patients. You have these patients who are coming through who are in terrible straits. But on the other hand, you don't have any time to figure out what's really going on. And there were important early successes based on hunches that my uncle and many others had. And there wasn't time to learn the real causes for things. And by the way, there's stories like this for surgery, surgical interventions, and for radiation as well. So there's some successes, but they still didn't find a general cure. And as you know, to this day, there still is no general cure for cancer. But things are a lot better, remissions are longer, and so forth. And now there's starting to be some understanding of the biological mechanisms, and one hopes that this will lead to deeper solutions. So there's this wonderful book, I strongly recommend, The Emperor of All Maladies, about the history of cancer. And I'll just read this. It is in vain to speak of cures or think of remedies until such time as we have considered of the causes. Cures must be imperfect, lame, and to no purpose, wherein the causes have not first been searched. Now, this, again, doesn't belie the fact that it can be very useful to go ahead and try to fix something along the way. But in the long term, you need to understand what's going on. So as opposed to just trying our bright ideas, which we all do, how about finding out what's wrong? The statistical approach to speech recognition requires assumptions that I've made reference to. They're known literally to be false. This may or may not be a problem. Maybe it's just handled by, say, raising these likelihoods to a power. How can we learn this? So there's some work that's been started I wanted to call your attention to from Steve Wegman and Larry Gillick starting a couple years ago, where what they did was to consider each assumption separately, and then rather than trying to fix the models, modify the data via some resampling, via some bootstrapping kind of approaches, to match the models, observe the improvements, and use that to inspire more bright ideas. Now, at this point, they're really just focused on the diagnosis part and not on the new bright ideas, frankly. So this is being pursued also at ICSI in the OUCH project, which is Outing Unfortunate Characteristics of HMMs. And I'm going to give you just a couple results from the more recent version. I should add, by the way, that this is a different Gillick. This is Larry's son, Dan, who just did his PhD with us. But first, this is a very simplified system, so the error rate for Wall Street Journal is pretty high here. And it's the output demonstrably does not really fit the GMM distribution that you got from the training set. And it definitely doesn't satisfy the independence assumptions, and you get this 13%. Now, if you simulate the data, really just generate it from the models, you should do pretty well, and in fact you do. Basically, virtually all of the errors go away. But here's the interesting one, I think. If you use resample data, so this is the actual speech data, but you're just resampling it in such a way to assure the statistical conditional independence, it also gets rid of nearly all of the errors. Now, their studies are a lot more detailed than this. There's a lot of things that they're looking at, a lot of things they're trying out, but I think this gives the flavor of what they're doing. So, in summary, speech recognition is mature. In some sense, it has an advanced degree, just because it's been around a long time and there are commercial systems and so forth. And yet, we still find it to be brittle, and we essentially have to start over again with each new task. The recent improvements have been really quite incremental. A lot of things have sort of leveled off. We need to rethink, kind of like going back to school, kind of like continuing education. We may need more basic models, more basic features. We may need more study of errors. And the other thing I want to briefly mention is that we do live in an era where there is a huge amount of computation available. And even though the clock rates don't continue to go up as they have due to many core systems and cloud computing and so forth, there is going to continue to be an increased availability to lots of computation. And this should make it possible for us to consider huge numbers of models and methods that we wouldn't consider before. For instance, on the front end side, these auditory-based or cortical-based things can really blow up the computation from the simplest kind of stuff that you have with MFCCs or PLP. So it's good to do that. It's good to try things that might take a lot of computation, even if they might not work in your iPhone just now. So you also have to know, and I'm sure you all do, that just having more computation is not a panacea. It doesn't actually solve things, but it can potentially give you a lot more possibilities. And that's pretty much what I wanted to say. I do want to acknowledge that the stuff I've talked about is not particularly for me. It's for many people, including people outside our labs. But I do want to thank the many current and former students and postdocs, visitors, ICSI staff, and particularly give a shout-out to Hina Kermansky, Hervé Bourlard, Shihab Shama, Steve Wegman, Jordan Cohn. And here's my shameless plug for our book, which Hina did already mention, and that is going to be out this fall, thanks to tons of work from Dan Ellis and other contributors, I should say, like Gerald Friedland and Simon King, for instance. And thank you for your attention. Okay.
Thank you very much. We have a luxury of having enough time for questions, so please, I encourage you, whatever is on your heart, now is the time to bring it up. And Morgan will be available to ease your mind of your problems. So.
Well. I promised I put on this ASRU thing to remind you about Hawaii. So.
Well, if nobody has a question, I do have a question, of course. I mean,
okay.
Among all these things which you mentioned,
yeah,
which may possibly be fixed in ASR,
yeah,
what do you think will be most promising? I know that this is kind of a little bit tricky and biased, but
yeah,
just speak your mind. No, don't
don't hold
afraid.
Back.
Don't be
yes,
afraid
yes,
of these
okay.
people. They had a chance to speak.
Yes. Well, they still have a chance. They still have a chance. They get their courage. I think that the right answer is, I don't know. Because, for instance, what I used to say when people would talk to me about this is that Okay, I think of speech recognition as being in three pieces. There's the representations that you have, there's the statistical models and the search and so forth in the middle, and then there's all of the things that you could imagine doing with understanding and pragmatics and semantics and so forth. And I used to think that, okay, the first one I know a little bit about, and I feel very strongly, and you know, there's plenty of results to back this up, that that's very important for improving things. The last one is not my area of expertise, but what I've seen in other areas, and certainly in human case, I believe that's very important. So I sort of thought the middle part, probably works well enough. But then saw this study, and now I'm not so sure. So I actually think that you should pursue whatever it is that you feel is of greatest interest. I actually think the key thing is to have interesting friends.
I see that Morgan is a good politician. I now see why he's wearing tie now.
No, that's what I actually
Nick
believe.
Lion is here. I'm sure that he has a good question.
Okay.
Got my courage up now. Is the mic on?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mine's louder, though.
All of these techniques you described are essentially spectral, short-time spectral analysis approaches. That's pretty much true of everything you described in your book and in almost all speech books that talk about front ends. Mm-hmm. The spectral techniques like MFCCs and PLPs have benefited from incorporating some aspects of auditory processing, of course, thanks to you two guys mostly. But the big problems, it seems to me, are still in interference from other sources, reverberation, spatial hearing and so forth, where the spectrum doesn't give you much help at distinguishing multiple sources or multiple directions and so on. The other dimension of fine temporal information is something that has been explored a lot in the psychological and, and to some extent physiological communities. There have been a few steps to use it, like Oded Gietz's ensemble interval histogram, but that kind of dropped the spectral dimension entirely, I think. So some kind of a duplex representation there seems like it's going to be needed in order to get at both the spectral and multi-source cues at the same time. You didn't say much about that, but that's the direction I'm pushing, and so that's my shameless plug. But what do you think about that direction, and how can we get people working in this field to pay more attention to things beyond spectral?
Well, by spectral, I guess what you mean is short-term spectral, right? And I may not have done this as clearly as I could, but I think the Shama stuff that I was making reference to certainly can be long time. There are spectral-temporal representations. What you feed the different quasi-cortical filters can be a very different kind of spectrogram, one that takes advantage of this sort of stuff, and I think that's absolutely what we should do. And it's these disturbances, the multiple sources, the reverberation, et cetera. I agree, that's the biggest challenge. That's the, if someone talks about the performance of humans versus speech recognition systems in the current generation of systems, that's the easiest place to show the difference. So I completely agree. Sorry, I'm not being a politician, I actually do agree.
And results on studying what's wrong with current HMM systems seems to suggest that most of the leverage is in the linguistic modeling end of things, which may be true in some tasks, but I see so huge a percentage of the effort in this field going into the linguistic modeling and big statistics and so little going into the front end. You know, most big speech groups these days, you'd be lucky to find one person who really understands front end. So I think we need to really encourage this group to put more attention in that end of the business.
Okay, I didn't pay him, but you certainly are reinforcing my biases. Good, George is getting up. But I'm mostly a front-end person these days, have been for a while, and I agree that there's a lot to be done there. I didn't mean to say at all that the language modeling and so forth was the bulk of it. Even that study at the end was just saying, for a fairly simple case with essentially matched training and test, that you could jimmy with the data in such a way
to match the model's assumptions, and you could do much better. But one of the things that we're going to be trying to do in follow-ups to that study is looking at mismatch conditions, looking at cases with noise and reverberation and so forth, in which case I don't think the effect will be quite as big. And, you know, it's garbage in, garbage out. If basically you feed in representations that are not giving you the information you need, how are you going to get it at the end? So I agree with you. But I was trying to be fair, not only to be political, but also because I feel that if you cover the space of all of these different cases, there are many cases where these other areas are in fact very important. And human beings, as with my baseball example, human beings do make use of higher level information often in order to figure out what was said and what was important about what was said, which leads me to George's question.
As you were talking, I was constantly struck with the analogy in speech recognition with almost, you know, irresistibly analogous things in optical character recognition. And so almost every slide you had these irresistible analogies from the current successes to future directions to problems that are being experienced. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering, is there a cross-disciplinary knowledge that can be leveraged there, and is it being leveraged?
To speech recognition, except in the sense that some of these alternative approaches have tried looking at the spectrogram as an image and so forth. Some of the neural network techniques that were developed in optical character recognition sort of came back the other way, but a lot of it's gone the other way. But, you know, we tend to be a fairly fragmented community and not listen to each other quite as much as we should, I think. Uh-huh. Who's next?
Is there a question?
No, I think he's
George, the floor is yours. I hope that you will.
Well, okay. I'm sorry. Up. I was trying to stay in my seat, but I couldn't let Dick Lyon's plug for the front end go unattacked. I've had some exposure, probably most people have had some exposure to modern speech recognition technology in real applications, and I'm thinking now of, I've been exposed to Google Voice, perhaps many people have, and this is not a plug for Google Voice, but I think modern deployed speech recognition technology, to me, is amazingly good, considering that the systems are decerebrate. They have no capability of integrating semantic context. And to see what people, see what these systems can do with the acoustics is amazing, to me at least. And so where I see the challenge to be met, and I don't know how to do that, but where I see the challenge is creating models of the semantic context to give the kind of support to speech recognition that we've seen from the n-gram language models, which don't model the semantic context.
Okay, well, that was a question. I know it wasn't. But I'll say something anyway, which is that I am really taking the middle position. There are plenty of tasks where, in fact, recognition does fail, particularly in noise and reverberation and so on. Google Voice search is very impressive, but you know there's a lot of cases where things do fail. And we can see significant improvements in a number of tasks by changing the front end. So I think there is something important there. But in your statement, you weren't really attacking the front end so much as saying we have to pay attention to the back end, and I completely agree.
One more,
and then it's probably time.
I want to change the subject a little bit.
Yeah.
Given the title, I was hoping you'd say something about the role of industry versus academia in this research. And since you've got a big foot in both sides, what is academia good for in speech research now, and where should we go?
I actually have a pretty small foot in industry, I think industry should fund the academia.
Okay.
Okay.
I think this is a good way to end this plenary. Okay, the coffee is waiting and cakes are waiting.
Thanks very much. Thanks for your attention.